Would like to move along here in our series of kingly lessons. So we are looking at the ups and downs of the kingdom period. If you're talking about the southern kingdom, as I bring our map up here, let me zoom out just a little bit so we can get an idea of how this kingdom was divided. Down here is the southern kingdom of Judah. And by the point we are in history, it has lost a lot of the power that it used to have. Because if you'll remember, David subdued Moab, he subdued Ammon, he subdued most of the Philistines, the Amalekites down here in the south, and as far north as Syria. So if I zoom way out, David had pretty much subdued everything within this circle and brought it into subjection to the Israelite kingdom. Solomon solidified that, even expanded it just a little bit with his marriage alliances, but then Rehoboam lost it, and he split it because of his ill decisions. And so everything about north of this line right here, so this area up here became the northern kingdom of Israel. So don't get confused. If it talks about Israel, it's not talking most of the time about the whole nation. It's talking about the northern kingdom, Israel. It's also called Ephraim, because Ephraim was the largest, most prominent tribe out of the 10 that were up there. The southern kingdom is called Judah, but it's not just the tribe of Judah. It also encompasses Benjamin and Simeon and portions of the other tribes who migrated south after the kingdom split. So we have looked at, as I bring up our timeline here, we have looked at Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. The kingdom split right here in 975. And Rehoboam ruled for 17 years. Rehoboam, good king, bad king? We'll test your memories here. Yeah, not a good king. What did he bring into the kingdom? Idolatry. He brought in idolatry. He brought in cult prostitution. He brought in, all manner of pagan worship. He did it worse than Jeroboam did. What was Jeroboam's big sin? The calves, right. One up north in Dan, the other down in Bethel, right on the border to the southern kingdom. So Jeroboam instituted this idolatrous worship, but Rehoboam really did quite a bit worse. So Rehoboam sleeps with his fathers, dies in 958 BC, and his son Abijam takes the throne. Abijam, good king, bad king? He's a bad king. He only reigns for 3 years, but it says that he did bad. He didn't seek the Lord. There was one battle in the beginning of his reign where he was fighting with Jeroboam, and he sought the Lord's help in that, and the Lord delivered him. But aside from that, he was a pretty faithless guy. So that brings us up to Asa, which we began looking at last week, the reign of Asa. Now Asa rules 41 years, which is quite a good long time. And so Asa sees the reign of Jeroboam. If you can look over here, this section is Jeroboam. So Jeroboam reigns up into the second year of Asa and then passes away. So this is somewhat where we are going to come back to, because we looked at Asa's reign last week. Asa, good king or bad king? He's a good king. Generally speaking, he was good. Doesn't mean he did everything right. Just like David was considered a righteous king, the friend of God. But did David do everything right? No, not at all. Asa's major problem, he went through and cleaned the kingdom, got rid of all the idolatrous worship, got rid of all the high places that were worshiping alongside of Jehovah, but he didn't get rid of the chapels to Jehovah that were in the hill country. But he restored a lot of the right worship to Judah during his reign. But we also noted that towards the end of his reign, there was a war with Baasha, and what did Asa do? Who did Asa ask for help? The king of Syria? Yeah, the king of Syria. So instead of going to God and asking for help, Asa takes all the treasuries of the temple and sends them north to the king of Syria. So if we go back to our map here and zoom out, Damascus is right here. This is the capital of Syria. So this kingdom of Syria, up here to the north of Israel, was a fairly large, fairly powerful one. And Asa, the king of Judah, instead of seeking Jehovah's help, sends this present to Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, and says, hey, I need you to attack Baasha, the king of Israel. So instead of relying on God's help, he goes to a third party. That was one of the major blunders of Asa's reign. One of the other things he did was, it says that in the end of his reign, he was sick in his feet. He was had some trouble with his feet. We don't quite know what it was. But what did he rely upon to heal him? The physicians. Instead of... So God doesn't want us to use physicians?
No, but he should have trusted God.
Right. So we can use physicians. They might be a God-appointed means for our healing. But ultimately, we've got to recognize that God's the healer, not the physician. The physician doesn't do anything unless God gives him the ability to do it. And so we seek God's deliverance. Now, that might mean going to a doctor. All right? It might. But Asa didn't seek that at all. He thought the physicians would help him. And so that brings us all the way to the end of Asa's reign. And we finished up with him verse 20, 24 there. Asa slept with his fathers, was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father, and Jehoshaphat, his son, reigned in his place. So that brings us all the way here to 914 BC. We have covered, so roughly 250 years of Israelite history from the beginning of Samuel till this point. So Samuel, we're not quite sure how old he was when he was born, but we're pretty sure he was born at an early age. And he, yeah, thank you. Somebody's laughing, okay. he governed Israel for quite some time, and we don't know how old he was when he perished, but he was getting to be pretty old. And then Saul reigned for 40 years, and then David reigned for 40 years, and then Solomon reigned for 40 years. So we have 120, maybe over 200 years of history wrapped up just in Samuel, Saul, Solomon, and David. And that brings us then up through 914 BC. Well, as per the norm for the writer of the Book of Kings, since he has finished up the reign of Asa here, he has not told us about several happenings in the northern kingdom. He focused on Asa in the southern kingdom. But the last we heard, there was a fellow ruling in the northern kingdom named Jeroboam. So the writer is going to back up, finish off Jeroboam's reign, and then catch us up in history. So we are backing up here in verse 25. Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, began to reign over Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah. So there we are. We just read about Asa's death, but now we're going all the way back to the beginning of his reign, second year. Anybody remember how long does Asa reign? 41 years. He's got a very long rule as far as the kings go. And so Jeroboam dies, and in the second year of Asa's reign, Jeroboam's son Nadab begins to reign. But he only reigns for 2 years. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father and in the sin which he made Israel to sin. So what does Nadab continue? The idol worship at Bethel. Right. He doesn't turn away from that at all. And so that's what classifies him as a wicked king. So we have had two kings in the northern kingdom, Jeroboam and Nadab, and they have both been wicked. In the southern kingdom, we've covered Rehoboam, Abijam, and Asa. And how many of them were wicked? Two, with one righteous one. So you see, the trend we're going to see in several hundred years of history, how many righteous kings are in the northern kingdom? I'm just, spoiler alert, okay? We're going to tell you. How many righteous kings in the northern kingdom? From the time of the division till the time that they're carried away to Assyria. How many righteous kings? Zero. Not a single righteous king will govern the northern kingdoms of Israel. Now, here's a fun thing to think. Well, we'll get into that here in just a moment. Let's cover Nadab. So Nadab reigns for 2 years. doesn't have a whole lot of accomplishment in 2 years. I mean, after all, it's hard to get your Congress to do anything in 2 years, isn't it? I mean, to get them to agree on anything. Baasha, we're in verse 27, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, of the house of Issachar, conspired against him. And Baasha struck him down at Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines, for Nadab and all Israel were laying siege to Gibbethon. So, let's go back to our map. I want to show you where Gibbethon is. Okay? We said right here is the line that separates the southern kingdom from the northern kingdom. Okay, right about there. Ephraim, you can see up here, this is the hill country of Ephraim. The kings of the northern kingdom have been jumping around from Shiloh to Bethel to Mizpah to Jokmeam, Shechem. They've kind of ruled wherever they were comfortable. Gibbethon is down here. I don't know if you recall way back when we were talking about David, but this green section all along the coast is the flat plain lands of the coastal region, and for quite some time had been inhabited by the Philistines. David brought a great deal of relief from the Philistines. If you remember, Samuel fought with them, Saul fought with them, David fought with them. Under David, the Philistines were reduced to tribute. They were never completely conquered, but they were reduced to tribute. So apparently something has happened in the last 65 years or so that have restored the Philistines back to power. A lot can change in a couple of generations, can't it? And so the Israelites are all gathered right here at Gibbethon. Here's the tent. Right there is the dot for Gibbethon. Okay. It's on the border of the plain country of the coast and the hill country of Ephraim. So right here on the border of Israel is this town called Gibbethon, and that's where Israel has gathered to fight the Philistines. Now remember that Nadab is he's only been in rule for 2 years. He's barely had time to unpack his suitcases. So he's probably trying to show some military strength here by conquering a big Philistine city. But Baasha doesn't want that to happen for some reason. So Baasha conspires against him in verse 28. So Baasha killed him in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. So here's the timing that happens. It tells us that he ruled for 2 years, right? But he started in which year of Asa? The second year. And he was killed in which year of Asa? The third. Is that two or one?
He could have started in like the middle of the year. Mm-hmm. And then gone from middle to middle, so it would actually be.
But that's still only a year. Daniel's saying if he like started in the middle of the year and then went to the middle of the next year, but that's still only a year, right? What's that? Beginning of one, end of another. Okay. You might be able to fit it in there. It wouldn't quite be 2 years. Here's what's going on. They count whatever year they started in as a whole year. So how many days was Jesus in the grave? Okay, I know all you that know your theology really well are saying 3 days, three nights, right? Was he in the grave for 3 days, three nights, as we would count it? No, he put in the grave Friday evening. He's there Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday morning he raises. It's not even 48 hours. But they say 3 days. How is that 3 days? Because he was there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. He was in the grave, okay? So you have to consider their method of accounting time. So let's say that the Israelite New Year begins in April, which is right about where it does. So Asa's second year right here begins in April of 956. April of 954 BC. 955. There it is. April of 955 BC. If Nadab takes the throne of the northern kingdom any time before the next April, that's still the first year of Asa's reign. If Nadab took the throne in March of the following year, we're in the first year of Asa's reign. In April, 1 month later, it becomes the second year. And so if Nadab is then killed in June, he could have only been on the throne for a couple of months, but still gets accounted as 2 years in the timing, because there were 2 calendar years of Asa's reign in which Nadab was ruling. Does this make sense? But this is how you have to put together these chronologies and understand how they timed this all out. So that's why you can make all of these things triangulate and put all the data together to come up with these nice little timelines. So Nadab probably was on the throne for an actual year and a few months, but it transpired during the second and third year of Asa's reign. So it gets counted as 2 full calendar years. Okay, so that's what's going on there. But after a very short rule, Baasha kills him. In verse 29, Baasha takes the throne. And as soon as he was king, true to form, this is what most heathen kings did, you secure the throne. Because obviously, you're in a tenuous position as the guy that just executed the former king. He just assassinated the previous ruler, so how do you make sure that you secure your position as king? Get rid of anybody else that could lay a claim to the throne. Right. And so that's what he does. He killed all the house of Jeroboam. He left to the house of Jeroboam no one that breathed until he had destroyed it. But interesting little thing added to the end of that sentence, isn't there? Why did he do it? Let's not say why did he do it. Why did it happen that way? Because it was according to the word of the Lord. Do you remember back when God sent a prophet to Jeroboam and said, your dynasty is done. Your house will not survive. And so here's the fulfillment of it. Just the next generation. Jeroboam died in peace. Nadab doesn't. He gets killed, assassinated while he's out to battle. And God is fulfilling his promise to Jeroboam. Because he told Jeroboam, if you don't obey me, I will strike your house down. You won't last. And here it comes to pass. He left to the house of Jeroboam no one that breathed until he had destroyed it, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. It was for the sins of Jeroboam that he sinned and that he made Israel to sin, and because of the anger to which he provoked the Lord, the God of Israel. Now the rest of the acts of Nadab and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? That's not our Chronicles, by the way. This is a different one. And there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. So Baasha takes the throne here in the third year of Asa, and for the rest of Baasha's 24 years, there is war, war, war. And it is that continual war that drags Asa down to the point that he's willing to call on Syria for help. Ever been in the position where you were trying to do what's right and it just kept crushing you? I mean, it just seemed like it kept piling on top of you. There was nothing you could do to get out of it. Most of us, after that kind of prolonged stress, stop making decisions about what is right and wrong, and we start making decisions about how to get out of a stressful situation as quickly as possible. And that's where we start making our mistake. We lose patience. Baasha lost patience. Doesn't mean he lost faith. He lost patience, though. And he started making decisions of how to relieve himself of the stress of continual war because of the wars that he had with Baasha. Well, if we're at the end of Baasha's reign here, well, actually, no, we're going to get to Baasha here. We're at the end of Nadab's reign. Verse 33, in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, began to reign over Israel at Tirzah. So here's the new capital, right here. Much farther north than some of the other ones, but there is Tirzah. Right up on top of these mountains. Great place to build a palace, by the way, on top of the mountains. Good view. Easily defensible. Nice place to put an army. Okay. And so that's where Baasha is going to build his capital city, on top of that mountain. And he reigned 24 years, so he has a pretty good long reign. Now, we're already in the second dynasty of the northern kingdom. There's Jeroboam's dynasty, and it lasted for two kings. Now we're in Baasha's dynasty. So already the second one, we're only three kings into this thing. There's going to be several others. I think, I forget what the number is, but somewhere around 14 different households rule over the northern kingdom. How many dynasties in the southern kingdom?
One.
One. Whose dynasty?
David's.
Why the difference? The Davidic covenant. God made a promise to David. You will always have somebody to sit on the throne. And so we'll constantly read that even if there was a wicked king in the southern country, it'll say God didn't completely eradicate him because of the covenant with David. We read that in regards to Abijam. He was a wicked guy, but because God had made a promise to David, God didn't obliterate Abijam's household. Well, God didn't make that promise with any of the northern kings. So when they act wickedly, God brings judgment, and their houses get eradicated. And so Baasha was sort of the instrument that that happened to. So here is Baasha. He's reigning over Israel for 24 years. And verse 34, he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he made Israel to sin. So what policy does Baasha continue that Jeroboam started? Which evil? This is pretty specific. The idolatry with the golden calves. That's the incident that is at reference here. When it says that he continued the sin of Jeroboam, it's talking about those golden calves. Any of these kings could have said, you know what, this is a really bad idea. We're still God's people, even though we're separated from Judah, but we should be ruling ourselves according to God's law. And they could have done that. But almost every king that establishes himself over the northern tribes does the same thing and continues Jeroboam's idolatry. And so Baasha does. So that puts us into chapter 16, verse 1. The word of the Lord came to Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha, saying, since I exalted you out of the dust and made you leader over my people Israel, and you have walked in the way of Jeroboam and have made my people to sin, provoking me to anger with their sins, behold, I will utterly sweep away Baasha and his house, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Okay, so what happened to Jeroboam's house? It's gone. There are no Jeroboams left. We are not, at this point, in any danger of not having any Kellys left. Because we have, my dad had two sons, me and my brother Mark. Mark has one son to carry on the family name. I have an uncle who has a couple of sons to carry on the Kelly family name. I have four sons to carry on the Kelly family name. So, and maybe one more coming, right? We'll see. We don't know yet. There are no more Jeroboams. All of his sons, all of his descendants have been wiped out. There's nobody left to carry on the Jeroboam family name. And so God tells Baasha, because you continued in Jeroboam's sins, I'm going to bring the same punishment on you that I did on Jeroboam. Your household is going to be obliterated. There will be no more Baashas. There will be no more people with whatever Baasha's last name might have been, right? And it's because you have provoked me to anger. I will utterly sweep away Baasha and his house. Well, this should be interesting because who did God use to sweep away Jeroboam's house? Baasha. So now Baasha has this interesting privilege of being both the mediator of God's judgment and the recipient of it. Not a position you want to be in. Kind of reminds you of what Paul says in Galatians, right? So you that are spiritual, take heed lest you fall. Okay, when we're restoring other people or when God is using us as an instrument of discipline in other people's lives, we have to be very careful lest we get this pride about us that says, look how much better I am than you. God doesn't use us because we're better. He uses us because we're tools. And I think God delights in using rusty tools, to be honest with you. Just so that when we get to the end of this whole thing and we look at what God creates, we're going to look back and say, how did he ever do that using us? And the answer is, because he's God. That's how great he is. Right? So Baasha is in this position of having been both the deliverer of God's judgment, now he's going to be the recipient of God's judgment. Anyone, verse 4, anyone belonging to Baasha who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat. And anyone who dies in the field, the birds of the heavens shall eat. That same curse was placed upon Jeroboam. It is a curse that says, you are not coming to the grave in peace. It's not a good thing. Definitely not a good thing. I think I skipped something. Now, there we go, verse 5. Now the rest of all the acts of Baasha and what he did and his might, are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? Once again, not your biblical book of Chronicles. If you go to your biblical book of Chronicles, you will not find a record of the northern kingdom. God didn't put it there. And the reason is the book of Chronicles is chasing the downfall and restoration of the Davidic line. So it's going to trace for you David's rise to power, the Davidic covenant, the fall of the kings of Judah, their captivity in Babylon, and then their return. So it's tracing the Davidic line. So it doesn't concern itself with the northern kingdoms. Only the book of 1 and 2 Kings tells us about the northern kingdoms. So when it's referencing this other historical work, we're not sure what that is. It might have been an official court document where they recorded all the works of the kings, but whatever it is, it's lost to us now. Verse 6, Baasha slept with his fathers, was buried in Tirzah, and Elah, his son, reigned in his place. Moreover, the word of the Lord came by the prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha and his house, both because of all the evil that he did in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger with the work of his hands, in being like the house of Jeroboam, and also because he destroyed it. So let's hang on a second. Why is God going to curse the house of Baasha? He gives two reasons. What's that? All the evil he did, but what two things specifically does he mention that were evil?
Destroying Jeroboam?
Didn't God tell him to do that? Baasha did it out of evil. Okay? So God is going to judge Baasha for doing what God said would happen? Isn't this a fun question?
It was a curse.
It was a curse. It was a curse upon whom?
Both.
Okay. You know an interesting thing you find when you start reading into the prophets like Isaiah and especially the later prophets, Ezekiel? Who did God use to discipline Israel?
Prophets?
Nope. The Babylonians, right? In 586, the Babylonians come and they completely destroy Jerusalem, the temple. They haul everybody off. 70 years of captivity. And guess what God says to the Babylonians? I used you as my instrument of judgment on my people, and now I'm gonna judge you for it. How does God judge the people that he used as his instruments of judgment? What's that?
Harshly?
Yeah. Eldon.
God
is God. You know what? That solves a lot of theological problems. If you just recognize God is God and we can't figure him all the way out, can we? Yep. God is God. Ah. So he did it justly, but they were evil. But didn't he use them? So God used evil. So God decreed evil. God could do that. Well, then isn't God to blame? We're getting a little off track here, but this is fun, isn't it? Evil's still evil? Okay. So we can take this all the way back to the beginning, because this kind of touches on this idea of why is evil in the world? Did God know Adam was going to sin? Did God decree that Adam would sin? Yes, he did. It was God's plan from the beginning. So look, if Jesus is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world, then this was God's plan, even in creation, that Adam would sin and that Christ would save. I mean, this has been the plan all along. God did not create the world, and then it fell, and then he decided to save it. God created the world, and his plan was it would fall. Adam would fall into sin. Now, did Adam have everything necessarily to not fall into sin? Adam had every capability to not fall into sin, right? So he had all the good things in the garden, all his needs provided for. He had a will that was free, and he could have chosen to obey God rather than disobey. But he didn't, and that was part of God's plan. So does God decree evil? Boy, this stretches your brain, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Eldon?
God's purpose
to show mercy. Okay, so he planned on evil so that he could show mercy. Wouldn't it have been better for God not to let us fall?
He didn't plan on it.
Oh, yes, he did. Foreknowledge does not simply mean a passive knowing, though. It means planning. When you look at the word foreknowledge in the New Testament, it doesn't have the idea of just sitting back and saying, what am I going to see is going to happen? Oh, ooh, Adam's going to sin. Because God knew that. Not just he knew it, God planned on it. Boy, this gets you into some sticky wickets, doesn't it? So, that is absolutely true. We would not. And so God, in his self-declaration of his own glory, decreed that evil should exist in this world so that we could see his greatness in judging it. Evil does have a purpose. We might not solve all of those conundrums tonight. Probably won't. But there is the biblical picture. God does decree that evil will happen. He doesn't make anybody sin. We know that from the New Testament. God never tempts anybody. But does God allow Satan to go around tempting people? And does God know what the outcome is going to be? And does God know that that's going to fit in with his plan? Absolutely. The individual is responsible for the decision. But God certainly does allow that decision to take place, and he knows it's going to take place. It all fits into his plan. Okay. So here's Baasha, whom God knew. God used Baasha as an instrument of judgment upon Jeroboam's house. But Baasha did it wickedly. He did it vengefully. Would it be right to assassinate the leader that God... Let's go back to this. Didn't God anoint Jeroboam over the northern tribes? Didn't God tell Jeroboam, I'm going to set you as the king there? Eldon? Okay. Yes. Because God put Saul there, right? God put Jeroboam there too. So should Baasha ever have laid a hand on him? And here's part of the distinction. Did God ever tell Baasha, I want you to go kill that guy? Never did. He foretold it. He said, I'm going to bring judgment on your house. And he didn't tell us who he was going to use to do it. But Baasha did not have a command from God to go do this thing, and so he did it wickedly. And so here's God saying, yes, I used you as an instrument of judgment on Jeroboam's house, but now I'm going to judge you for doing that because what you did was wrong. Sometimes, Eldon, you do just have to say, God's ways are not my ways, they're higher than my ways, and I'll never understand it, right? We know that God is not evil, he never does evil, he never tempts to evil, but God's plan includes evil. Well, that brings us right up to about where we're going to have to pause here. So we have another curse that God has brought against Baasha, and we'll see how that fulfills itself here next week. Lots of names, lots of dates, lots of timelines, lots of events happening here. Any questions about any of it?